It is Saturday, October 18th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, the week in geek news. In the second half, your questions and comments about technology. Welcome to GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today in GeekSpeak, we are taking your calls and questions of technology. That's in the second half. Questions about technology, even. In the first half, we're going to be doing the geek news of the week. We've got three wonderful geeks in here to help out. But for the second half, please take down these numbers now. 1-800-655-5877 and 476-2800 and one of my favorite numbers, 72. In any case, the two first numbers are the phone numbers, and you're welcome to use those during the second half to ask us questions. And if you want to get your question right now, you can go ahead and send us an email, and we might actually get it on air. But of course, we'd love to hear your voice. So again, the phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again in a half an hour when I invite you to participate. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Miles Elam, student, programmer, and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Let me turn your mic on. Good morning.
Good morning.
There you go. We also have Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe is a freelance media dude. That means he knows all about media, and you can hire him. Hi, Ben.
Woohoo. Hi.
And we also have John Tracy, technical support at Acceleron. Acceleron?
Acceleron.
Acceleron.
Morning.
Morning, John. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Now, John, you are... most of the time when we have you on, you're kind of known as the space geek.
That's because I'm spacey.
You're spacey. Do you have any space news for us today?
I do. Let's start actually in space with the Hubble Space Telescope.
The best camera ever made by man is what I like to call
it,
but it might not be true.
It's been called the best scientific instrument ever created by man. But okay. The LHC is actually kind of put that in contention.
Have more news about that, too.
Have more news about that. Mm-hmm. It's been a bad month for both of them. On September 27th, Hubble Space Telescope had a failure in the Site A science data formatter, and the SICNDH, which is the Science Instrument Command and Data Handling, that's the important part, system failed. So it was no longer able to send images back down to Earth. So it no longer was working. So
that's not good for a scientific instrument.
Right. So they put it into safe mode. It automatically shuts off. It's a fail safe. It goes into safe mode. They were bringing the different instruments back up.
So bring it up without drivers and networking capabilities.
Holding down shift when it was booting up.
Your Hubble Space Telescope. So on Wednesday, they were bringing it back up. And two more components look like they've possibly failed. The solar blind channel. The wide planetary camera came up and the infrared camera came up. Multi-object spectrometer. I'm just looking through the list of things that work.
So how some things work?
The advanced camera for surveys had a low power voltage warning, and it software let it start up.
Is it working or not now?
Not working. Two more things broken, working. Oh. They were going to send up a mission to fix it in October. To service it. It was a scheduled servicing mission.
Sure.
The cool thing about this telescope is when they launched it 15 years ago,
wow,
is they thought, maybe technological advances will continue and we'll want to upgrade this thing. So they made it upgradable. So the astronauts were going to be taking up some new packages, replacing all the gyroscopes, installing new batteries, you know, all the things you need to do to keep it running. That all got scrubbed because of this, so they're probably not going to launch until February of next year.
That's depressing.
But the good news is they're going to fly a bunch of new equipment up that they would not have normally. Well, they're considering flying new equipment.
That wouldn't have been in the schedule if they'd done it on time.
Right. So that'll replace the systems that have broken.
Okay, thanks, John. We'll move on to Mr. Jaffe. Ben, go for it, man.
All right, so Apple has released some new laptops.
We're going to jump into that? I thought we were going to do some news and then jump into that.
Well, I was just going to say that I'll jump into that later. Okay.
No, no, let's do the Apple thing. It's fine.
We're doing it?
Yeah,
all right,
sure.
We're doing it. Okay.
Okay, so Apple releases some new notebooks the other day.
Yeah, they've completely, even more so, blurred the line between the MacBook and the MacBook Pro. And those are the two models that Apple has. And they have different different models within that. But those are the two main ones.
Traditionally, when we're talking about that, we're talking about the metal-cased MacBook Pros and the plastic white or black MacBooks.
And you might also know them by the names iBook and PowerBook. Before the Intel transition, that's what their names were.
Okay.
Well, now they're all made of metal, and there are a lot of positives and there are a lot of negatives as well. So just going to try and run through this huge, huge list of positives and negatives. So I'm just going to run through it.
But earlier we were like chatting before the show. You were kind of griping about what bad mistakes they made. I'd like to ask you what good things they did first.
Exactly. That's exactly what I want to cover is first positives. So the MacBook Pro actually has two video cards built in and you can switch between them. And the advantages of that is that you have the GeForce 9400M, which has 256 megs of RAM, and it's much more low power than the other one.
Let me cover this a little bit, because this is interesting. This is actually a chipset feature by NVIDIA that is kind of impressive. The mobile version also includes the entire chipset of the motherboard, which is really exciting, which means that the memory controller, the SATA controller, USB, is all on this one chipset, which also has a graphics card on it. And that graphics card is a low-power graphics card, which actually has pretty good performance, and will do your general tasks. So, and that's the same card that's actually in the MacBook, the lower-end Mac. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that card will function as a graphics card like we normally see. Traditionally, the MacBooks have had an Intel chipset and an Intel graphics card on them.
So that's a score for NVIDIA.
And so this is, big score for NVIDIA, actually. I'm really surprised NVIDIA's stock didn't jump up after this.
Well, on the MacBook side, they ditched the Intel graphics. NVIDIA was already in the graphics for MacBook Pro.
And that's right. The chipset for the MacBook Pro prior to this change was an Intel chipset with a graphics card added on by either ATI or NVIDIA. I think, Miles, you have an NVIDIA one and I've got an ATI one.
Right.
And that was like an add-on card. And that's traditionally how you do it on a more powerful thing because you want a really powerful video card. So what they're doing is that even on the high end, when you're going to have an add-on graphics card, which they include with it, which is an NVIDIA graphics card, you're also going to have a built-in card. And the main reason for that is there's two reasons for it. One of the reasons is the power performance. Mm-hmm. The chipset one, when you're not like running a game or something, you don't have to power up your high-end power card, and you can get lower.
Like four hours of use versus five or something. It's like a pretty tremendous difference.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a difference, and everyone knows that when you've got a really powerful graphics card, you've got a giant heat sink, which means you've got a lot of waste. So though the powerful graphics card's in the MacBook Pro, it also can turn it off, which is cool. Additionally, and this is something that Apple hasn't touted, but the press release from NVIDIA is talking about, is that you don't actually choose which graphics card to do. You use both graphics card in an SLI format. SLI is a technology from NVIDIA, which allows you to add two graphics cards at the same time. So it's possible that they'll enable this ability for the chipset graphics card and the other graphics card to work at the same
time.
True,
though by default it's actually not enabled. It's not possible, actually, unless they release.
And the biggest question for me is, and this is what comes down to a release from Adobe a while ago. Adobe 4, CS4, is enhanced to run better filter support. Some of its algorithms
more GPU acceleration
through
yeah.
the graphics card.
Now, that said, having these GPUs in there, people might say, like, well, what's the point? I don't play games. And Apple hasn't really fostered games on their desktop systems or their laptops. But NVIDIA has that technology, CUDA, I think it's called.
CUDA, yeah, that's what I was kind of talking about with the Photoshop filters. They're using CUDA, too.
Right, but also the upcoming operating system, Snow Leopard, has a lot of stuff made for taking advantage of the GPU as a separate coprocessor.
Right.
So you know, this is basically like priming the hardware for the software change that's coming up.
Back in the day, when Diamond was releasing their graphics cards, there were people that developed graphics engines that went only with that graphics card. And that's kind of what we're seeing. CUDA is an open standard that NVIDIA has kind of pushed forward. It only runs on NVIDIA stuff, I think, at this point.
Oh,
but it's basically the ability
Apple's
to...
calling it OpenCL.
OpenCL, So OpenCL is actually a CUDA implementation, I believe. But in any case, CUDA is the graphics card ability to process in a massively multi-parallel processor, which is the graphics card, and actually write basic code for that. So you could see some really amazing performance with video encoding. Like, I'm assuming that Adobe will have After Effects actually do using the graphics card, so the processor can deal the normal tasks, and the graphics card is kicking out your frames for you. It's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. And number processing, and you know, I can see programs like Mathematica or the like using it extensively.
So that's piece one of a very extensive list. Also, the MacBook Pro. So the MacBook has used, instead of DVI or VGA, which are graphics ports, it uses Mini DisplayPort, which is really, really, really cool. DisplayPort in general. Mini DisplayPort, we're not exactly sure like how much of the functionality of DisplayPort it maintains or it retains. But in any case, it is a it seems like it could go somewhere nice. And now the MacBook Pros, the new MacBook Pros, use DisplayPort, and the advantages of that
the MacBook Pros using the straight DisplayPort.
Yeah, so
that's really good news.
All of them are. Well, it's good news and it's bad news. It's good news because you can't easily bend the pins in the connector like you can with DVI. So especially if you have kids, you know, putting like a fork in your.
Let me explain that the DisplayPort looks a lot like a wider USB port. It's kind of that kind of
form
factor.
It's wider, thicker. Yeah. No, it's about the same width, but it's thicker. It has no thumb screws. It kind of just clicks into place and is well designed in that case. There's some more good news. At least one display is directly supported and actually has only a Mini DisplayPort. Any guesses as to who manufactures that?
Apple.
Apple, yeah. And actually, they released a 24-inch LED cinema display, which is available in November, which seems pretty cool. But anyway, so if you want to use it with a non-new laptop, you need an adapter.
Okay, so let's talk about all the features that are exciting. What's wrong with these MacBooks?
What's wrong?
Because it sounds like you hate Apple at this point.
Oh, no. That's not true. Well, okay, I want to really fast run through the rest of them. It's important. So they're constructing these new MacBooks out of one solid piece of aluminum instead of a whole bunch of different pieces. So you get the rigidity, you get less weight. And
okay, you're
it's
sounding like an
processor.
Apple commercial.
I'm sorry.
Stop. Let's move along.
We have blah, blah, blah.
No, it is a cool thing, though.
It's a breakthrough, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's
so
a breakthrough.
Let's talk about machining then for 10 minutes. Do you want to talk about machining for 10
minutes? No. I just want to hit on
it. Well, here's the problem is that if we're hitting on the bullet points, it sounds like an ad. If we're talking about why it's cool, it's giving our input. And I'm okay with giving your input, but means... So the reason a machine part is so nice, it really comes down to, if you see, you can see how they're cutting and everything.
Yeah.
Traditionally what they've done is they've done a skin, and inside the skin they've got a skeleton structure, and that's how it's been done. And the problem with that, of course, is that the skeleton structure, this structure that's actually strong is this skeleton type structure, which is a whole bunch of like little veins, and those have been cast aluminum, I believe. And that's the parts that were really difficult to deal with when they crack. For John, I know you have a lot of experience with that because you've
you
had
to
a broken
screw them all together with a splice.
Yeah, it's a mess. So this new idea is that you take a block of aluminum and you cut out all the stuff you don't need, leaving instead of a skin and a skeleton, you kind of have like a crab shell kind of form. Where
and it's still strong because it has the original crystalline structure of the aluminum is intact.
That's right. The extruded aluminum gets a good structural integrity when it gets extruded.
And you're not disrupting that crystalline structure when you mill it. You are when you cast it.
Right, because you're casting, you're heating up again, and then it's a random structure. So that's the benefit of the machining part. And I hear that it feels really good. So it's strong, feels really good, looks real good. Okay, next benefit.
We'll just move on to the negatives. I mean, you seem to be keener on the negatives than the positives.
Well, everybody's talking about the positives. Apple talked about the positives. Let's talk about the negatives.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
If you want to see the positives, you can go to www.apple.com.
Right,
they'll tell you
well,
all
if you
about
want to
positives.
See the negatives, you could go to any of the websites that are reviewing these.
Such as ours. So let's go.
Okay. Some of the negatives is that the MacBook Pro now uses Mini DisplayPort, and the negatives of that is
you say Mini DisplayPort or DisplayPort?
Mini DisplayPort. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So
yeah, DisplayPort is full size fatty. It's
so
a lot larger.
The MacBook Pro does not do DisplayPort; it does Mini DisplayPort.
Both. All of Apple's laptops now.
Okay, so that's unfortunate.
Aside from the Air.
See, before it was the MacBooks, the low-end ones, had the Mini DisplayPort.
And then
the MacBook
Pros
had a full-size DVI.
Yeah, right. And part of the reason why they made that move is because now all of their ports are on the left side of the laptop, which is actually a really interesting... it's kind of neat. And then the optical drive is on the right. Much like on the MacBooks. So they've kind of, again, the lines being kind of blurred between what the differences are between their, you know, MacBooks and their MacBook Pro line.
So what's wrong with the Mini DisplayPort?
I have frustrations because I'll need to carry around an adapter until Mini DisplayPort becomes a standard. Uh-huh. And that's always the problem with early adoption. I think it's probably a good idea. HP, Philips, Samsung, Lenovo, AMD, NVIDIA, Intel, and a bunch of other companies actually say that they're going to back Mini DisplayPort.
No, they don't. They say they're going to back DisplayPort. This is the problem I have with it.
Oh, that's true.
So Mini DisplayPort is this Apple-created thing. It's not a standard. It's using the same signaling, mm-hmm. but it's a different connector. Miles, you had an issue?
I was actually thinking, in terms of the DisplayPort, Mini DisplayPort issued, I'm remembering my G4 PowerBook that had a DVI. And in those days, DVI was more expensive. Everything, all the LCD panels had VGA.
That's right.
So this is more of the same. This is kind of like the march of progress.
It's going to go forward. The thing is, if they use the DisplayPort, I would totally agree with you. But since they use the Mini DisplayPort, mm-hmm. I don't know if that will ever be something that's a standard. It might just always be one of these Mac names. Like the DVI, yeah, that's a standard. Everybody's going to do that. So mm-hmm. that Apple did it first, and it was a little weird at first, and then we started getting used to it, is cool. But that they're using a Mini DisplayPort, I think that's a mark
but
against them.
I think they were also doing it because they're on a laptop. They don't have the real estate for it. I see a whole bunch of other laptop manufacturers going that Mini DisplayPort route.
Okay, well, Apple makes some money.
Also, like Ben was saying, you can't bend the pins in the connector.
Yeah, but that's a lot of problems. Yeah, definitely.
Things are moving toward DisplayPort. DisplayPort, the full DisplayPort, is larger, more bulky, harder to deal with than a laptop. I actually see them making, my own personal opinion, I think they made the right choice.
Okay.
And I think more laptop manufacturers will go that route.
All right. What else did they lose?
A lot of people were expecting them to come out with a Blu-ray optical drive in the new ones, but they didn't do that. Yeah. Jobs said Blu-ray's a bag of hurt is line. And, speaking mainly about licensing and everything.
Yeah.
So maybe that was a good choice. Maybe it was a bad choice, but we're still stuck with the dual layer 8x burners. And the big one.
Wait.
Actually, I have a comment about that Blu-ray because if you're watching a high definition movie on a laptop, because of the amount of data being transferred, the amount of power is going to be transmitted, a lot of times you'll put that in and you won't be able to watch the complete movie over the course of that airplane trip.
Now,
will be sucked down.
And specifically, because of the Blu-ray, you've got a higher intensity laser. You've got more expense there from the power consumption, but potentially. But also, if you do want to watch a high def on a movie on one of these machines, you'd want to transfer it to your hard drive of the machine so the machine can rev up, put a whole bunch into memory.
And when you're talking about a 15-inch screen as well, the advantages of 1080p are not as advantageous as you have on a 46-inch TV.
Yeah. Okay, next
and
item?
It's slow getting off the ground anyway, mm-hmm. High def
next
DVDs.
Item,
this is the big one. No FireWire on the MacBooks. And the MacBook Pros have FireWire 800 like they do currently, but they don't have FireWire 400
anymore. And this is a big problem.
This is a big, big problem.
Because what's happening right now, for example, at UCSC, the film department requires you to have a computer, a laptop. Mm-hmm. And the software they teach and use is Final Cut. And they tell all their students, you can get Final Cut on your notebook, and you use a FireWire external drive to store the data off of it. And all of a sudden, you can't get a MacBook to do that.
And most
of
the cameras use
And all the
FireWire.
Cameras.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, the question is, what do we lose with this? I mean, you know, we gain some things. We gain all the ports on one side. But what do we lose? We lose a lot of things. We lose a lot of external hard drives, though they have been kind of pushing more toward USB than FireWire. Yeah. Still, if you do, like I do video work, and if you really do measure it, FireWire, though it doesn't look as good on paper, FireWire 400 is actually faster than USB by small margins. But
and that's normally due to CPU utilization.
And then the other big thing we lose, and this is
wait, let's talk about FireWire for more. What are they going to do about that? Like, how are you going to, like, the Apple's all into this whole lifestyle thing, go videotape and then come back and put on your computer.
Absolutely. Like with GarageBand, iMovie, iDVD, they're like, oh yeah, you make your own DVDs, make your own films, make your own music. And you can't use, one of the things you lose pro audio interfaces.
I want to talk about FireWire for a second.
In FireWire.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
This is all under that umbrella.
The
FireWire.
Audio breakout boxes are
Audio breakout boxes and interfaces and mixing boards. pro DV cameras and a lot of HDV cameras. New HDV cameras do you use USB or at least have that option. But yeah. I mean,
but aren't these all? We're all talking about high-end video equipment,
in the general sense,
prosumer.
This is not. But they're not necessarily the things that you would have for the general consumer.
For the
market.
Audio breakout boxes and stuff, that's true. But for the FireWire hard drives and for the video cameras, that is everybody has a FireWire camera. Like the, any small mini DV camera you have, the interface is FireWire.
Well, because for example,
you can transfer pictures and things like that with USB, but not video.
A lot of the cameras, video cameras and still cameras, have in the last 3 years have had USB interfaces. The higher end cameras are FireWire.
Okay, do those do those USB interfaces support video?
No, they don't.
The standard DV, the way to transfer DV information, which is digital video, which is what these mini DVs are actually storing, is through the DVI connect, the DV connector, which is FireWire. Like that's the standard. Now, it's possible that people have been doing more USB 2 because you can transfer the rate through USB 2. I haven't played with a camera that can capture through USB 2.
I guess what I'm saying is that
some HDV can, but it's not standard.
It basically makes
Apple to drop
a college student that has this is the issue is that these notebooks that are like under $1,000, about $1,000, like that, the MacBooks, it makes them not be a media center like traditional the MacBook is.
Except that this is going to push for cameras to have a USB centric, which a lot of them are already moving that way.
If you're buying
If you're buying new hardware, which is this is the case if you're buying a new MacBook, and chances are you're going to be having a camera. I mean, assuming that you're buying a camera as well, like you're a new college student, you're going to get the two that match up. You're going to get the camera that is USB capable.
Sure.
If you have something that's more high end, if you're getting something that and you have an existing investment, and if that means you're more of an enthusiast, you're more of a professional,
you buy
you're going to go to the higher end one that's going to have the graphics processing that the MacBook Pro has.
Okay.
I don't mean to sound like an ad, but I mean like there's
not
there is a differentiation there.
User, you're not going to go out and buy a new camera and a new laptop.
That's right. Let's agree to disagree on this one. Okay. I think that we could talk more about it, but let's not. What's the next thing, Ben?
And then briefly, of course, with the MacBook Pros, you have to carry around a FireWire 800 to 400 dongle, which I just really don't like dongles.
See, here's the thing. I switched to FireWire 800 external closures. So right now I've got a 800 drive with a 800 to 400 connector. So I'm okay with going to 800. Like it makes sense to me.
Yeah, but I mean, I can carry my laptop into a room currently, my MacBook Pro, and plug it into pretty much anything. I won't be able to do that anymore.
Yeah.
With DVI, I'll need a dongle. With FireWire, I'll need a dongle.
So this and goes down to what, Miles, what you're saying is that, you know, these features are they're advancing to the next layer, level, whatever, and people are going that way, and the technology around us will follow.
Yeah, right now you have a problem, just like, you know, years ago with the G4 PowerBook, you had a problem with DVI, having to carry around a DVI to VGA dongle.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm wondering is, in 2 years' time, assuming you have the same laptop, that which, I mean, is a fairly safe assumption.
So,
it's a brand new laptop.
Yeah.
That if someone gets their brand new laptop, you're going to have more and more DisplayPort so that the older laptops are going to start having to carry around the dongles, whereas the laptops you buy now will have to carry the dongles less and less.
Let me add one more complaint about that new Apple PowerBooks and such. All of them have a high gloss screen.
Mm-hmm.
And the high gloss versus low gloss screens, they look really cool in the commercials. Like the high gloss looks really cool. But when you're actually seeing an environment with any kind of light around you and you have reflections on it, it's very disturbing. Like
I prefer the matte screens.
The matte screens are much preferred. The only way to get a matte screen now after these release is to get a 17-inch, which is a non-updated one.
Yeah.
And that, to me, just is wrong. They should have the matte screens.
But on the non-matte screens, can you fix your hair?
No, I can't see myself without turning the camera
on. You can. You can turn on the camera.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, darn it.
Wow. Well, that's the first half of Geek Speak. are we done? You want to wrap
it up? I think it's not a really fatal mistake that Apple's making, but I think it's a really bad move. Because briefly, if you look at the other things that Apple's been really kind of on the front line of dropping technologies that don't work anymore with floppy disks and with built-in modems.
Sure.
But I don't think that FireWire is even close to dead right now.
No, I agree.
And
FireWire 400 isn't.
So I think it's a bad move.
The switch to FireWire 800 to get rid of the ports on the right-hand side is fine with me because I hate it when I have a mouse and I'm bunting into the cables. But I don't think one dongle for an 800 cable is a problem. But for 800 to 400, but the drop for FireWire on the MacBook is a serious slap in the face to college students.
And there's no expansion to add FireWire card.
Well, isn't there one of these ports, one of the PCIe card slots?
That's where I'm going to backpedal some. Wow. Is that you don't have a FireWire, but you also don't have any way of expanding it like through an Express Card 34 slot, which the MacBook Pro has.
There's some USB to FireWire to USB,
why
do you want to do that?
Yeah, that's not
at the same point. The MacBook is a cheap machine. I mean, it's not cheap, but it's not horribly expensive. Anyway, let's go on. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For more information, you can go to, give Dr. Ramirez a call, 423-2447. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. We are taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Tune in to Talk of the Bay Sunday evening at 7 p.m. when host Rachel Ann Goodman speaks to Lori Kletzer, professor of economics at UCSC, about the untold story of the economic crisis, wages, and jobs. If you're wondering what's in store for the job market on the Central Coast, tune in or call in. That's Talk of the Bay Sunday evening at 7 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, we have Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and John Tracy. And behind the scenes, we have Rick Philman answering the phones, which means you can call in. 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Borrego Solar, offering photovoltaic solutions to enable homes and businesses to be green and resource savvy with sharp solar panels. Borrego.com has 28 years of experience and a local team ready to help. Information at borregosolar.com. All right, we'll be taking your calls now, but I do want to get at least one story of Miles's in before we do that. So, Miles, you pick the one you really want to talk about, and we'll keep going.
We talked last week about quantum cryptography, briefly.
That's right, a fiber optic solution to make using quantum
effects. Right, which was... Very cool item. However, it did have one main drawback, according to security researcher Bruce Schneier.
What was that?
It doesn't solve the pressing problem of security. This thing will handle the transport, but cryptography over our links, like, for example, when you go through an SSL or TLS link.
When you use Amazon to buy stuff, for example.
Right. Mm-hmm. That is not the weak link. In fact, 128-bit for a session, someone could spend a fair amount of time trying to break it, but it's relatively safe. It's really not our weakest link. As it turns out, our weakest link is us, people. Mm-hmm. That how do you bypass security? Like Google's CAPTCHA system. Like how do people get past that? Well, you could think, well, you put a computer behind it and try to OCR it, but they run into all sorts of problems. No, people who who have a desire to spam through Gmail system will simply go to the Gmail site, get the CAPTCHA, take that image, put it up on a bogus site, probably with porn or gambling or something like that, and say, hey, fill out this CAPTCHA to play our game. And so you have someone else solving the CAPTCHA for them, which then goes back in the database.
So,
and they go
and when you do this in an automatic form, it's relatively simple to do. You just have a whole bunch of sites out there that
as long as you have an infrastructure.
This is kind of funny. The original term for computer were the people in the 1800s who would do the mathematical calculations needed to make these navigational charts.
Right.
That was the original word. That was the original term when computer was first used. That's what it was. It was someone who did the computations for these navigational charts. No. So here we go. Once again, we're going back to human computers.
Now, I do want to mention, though, just as an aside, speaking of security, it's not so much security, but it is becoming more and more of a problem, is the lack of IP version 4 addresses. This is the IP address that all of us have on our computer. And there is a push to go to IP version 6, 128-bit key, which means that we wouldn't run out. One of the concerns about it is the fact that it is you have larger numbers running around. It's people worry about it being more inefficient.
I'm sorry, just a second. Does this connect to the whole thing about...
Well, I figured Ben had like a three-hour
session. That's fine, but we didn't really address the weakest link as a human being. But right. The CAPTCHA example you answer is not actually...
That's showing the strongest link is the human being.
That shows, that's not exactly a great example.
Well, that's true.
A better example is a company calls and says, please give us your credit card information because we need to update our records.
Right, or the banks. You get an email saying, hey, we've had an issue with our security, please. Or
click on this link to fix your system.
Or we have some, our database is going out of date, so we need you to, go in and make sure that
it's
you
called,
still want to keep
yeah,
it active.
It's called social engineering. And the first podcasted episode, first updated episode to our website in, I don't know, 4 years ago or something, was with Kevin Micknick. He's a famous social hacker. And he has a book. He had a book at the time, and that's why we spoke with him. But it's a great listen if you want to know more about how people can actually be the weakest link in a computer system. So what you're saying is the solution, that cryptography is not the real problem.
Yeah, it's a very neat
Okay,
tech.
So your next news story, Miles, please, go ahead. Sorry.
As I push my way through.
IP version, the way that computers talk to each other right now is IP version 4.
Right.
Which is running out of numbers. In fact, China is going to run out of numbers pretty quick.
Except there is a fairly sizable pool of companies that have IP addresses that are running foul, that aren't being used, which we can reclaim. But at the same time, even if you reclaim them, we're still looking at maybe 2015 before we run out of addresses and you start going into the auction block and it becomes a whole mess. So you get more addresses, and that's where IP version 6 comes into play, except no one really is adopting it. It recently showed up, I know, in an Apple Home Gateway kit, but very few manufacturers are really embracing it yet, and more importantly, the ISPs haven't embraced it yet. Mm-hmm. I know that, for example, my service, I can't get it yet for my DSL line. And one of the concerns is also IP version 6 has more processing power. So how do you get it into one of these kits?
Right.
Well, there is a company that has been working on this, and it's actually a conglomeration together with Cisco, Atmel, Swedish Institute of Computer Science, that they have created an IP version 6 stack that has a code size of 11 kilobytes and a dynamic memory usage of less than 2 kilobytes.
Nice.
Not megabytes, kilobytes.
Nice. So it might be that the physical problems are non-existent. I mean,
so
obviously
this,
having
this makes it more available for embedded systems. And IP version 6, where everything has its own IP, this is opening up the door for these really small, like literally a pen device that has some wireless transmitter on it that you can use. This is making it a lot more available. So all it matters now is people to adopt it, to start asking their ISPs, hey, where's your IP version 6 support?
Cool.
I want to get on this. I want to get on board.
Wow. 5 × 10^28. That's how many addresses will be available per person that currently exists right now?
Right.
5 × 10. That's like 2^95.
Right.
Think that clears it all up.
Well, no. I mean,
you can have almost a Google of computer or IP addresses per person on the planet that exists right now.
A Googleplex?
IPv6.
No.
It would be along the lines of you could give an IP address to just about
what
everybody.
What
was
the
number? To the 95th. Sorry, it's not a Google.
To the 95th. Not even close. No. But what's – yeah, go on.
Give an IP address to every square centimeter on the planet.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking on that
crazy
scale.
It's crazy now. Right.
Or maybe a square millimeter, actually. But
it's – a very large number.
10 billion, 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 billion addresses per person.
John, before we're going to take news in just 1 second, John, but I really did want to find out what's happening with the LHC. There was the Large Hadron Collider went offline, and then there's all this talk about like it's going to be offline for a long period of time, but the truth is that it was never planned
to
be online.
Right.
This
LHC is a Large Hadron Collider. It's in Switzerland. It's a particle collider. It collides two particles together. They blow up, and we find lots of cool particles, maybe some we've never seen before, like the Higgs boson particle. Anyway, this collider uses so much energy that they can't power it and heat all the homes in the area during the winter. So, you know, the cost for doing that would just
it's
be prohibitive.
It's in Vienna?
They can, but it would be significantly less cost effective.
It would be so expensive that it would overrun CERN's budget.
So in the winter, they've always planned to be in like a repair mode.
Exactly, yeah. So they plan to bring it down, do maintenance during the winter. The only thing that happened was there was a faulty electrical connection. There was a solder. There's like 10,000 solder joints on this machine.
Right.
One of them went bad. It introduced some soot into the vacuum tube, and that's really important because they fling these particles around.
That must be a vacuum.
Lead isotopes. Yeah, they can't run into anything, or you know, it's all screwed up. The science won't work. So it has to be a perfect vacuum tube, 17 miles long. Right. So it squirted a little dust into there. That sucks because they have to, you know, clean that out perfectly.
Literally,
it destroyed approximately 5 quadrupole magnets. And a quadrupole magnet, you know, a magnet normally has 2 poles, north and south. Quadrupole magnet has 2 north poles and 2 south poles.
And this is the thing that actually steers the electron beams.
Exactly. It guides the lead isotope as it travels through the tube.
So what we're talking about is a giant tube that's 17 mile diameter.
Right.
And inside it is nothing.
Exactly.
That's really important because if anything's in the way, the beam will hit it.
And then
these large magnets have to take all the particles and make sure that it's in the center of the tube so it doesn't collide with the wall. So you're really
accelerate it,
right? So a solder joint failed, got some solder particles, got sucked into the tube, if you will.
The atmosphere pushed it, and then
something damaged the tube got damaged, or some of these magnets got damaged.
A bunch of helium leaked out. The temperature rose, and in the ensuing, I don't know exactly what damaged the magnets. I don't know the exact mechanism, but five quadrupole magnets and 24 dipoles, which are standard magnets, were damaged. So
how long is it offline?
Well, they say that they will be able to repair it for its scheduled return to operation in the spring. They say that within their budget, they will be able to fix everything that's gone wrong. They have spares. Right. And they're also going to be writing a computer program that's looking at all the data they received when this happened so that in the future, if they see these same fluctuations, it can shut the machine down without damage.
Nice. Thanks for that update. Let's go ahead and start taking some news because, hey, we do that sometimes. And if you'd like to ask us questions, please feel free.
Some news?
Some calls.
Calls would be better than news. We've had enough news.
Calls are even more new.
What's going on with current events in your computing life?
That's right. Mm. Well, specifically, actually, in Santa Cruz. Oh, and he left. Oh, why? All right. Well, we'll go ahead and talk to Nick real quick. Nick and Aptos, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Did you have anything to add about the MacBook?
No. I was thinking of buying one, and I was wondering that on the loss of the FireWire, I sometimes hook up computers to each other using FireWire, where one then acts like a dumb terminal,
are you talking about target disk mode?
Yeah, target disk mode, where you shut the machine down on a Mac and you hold the T button as you boot it up, and it turns into a FireWire drive.
Right, and I use that feature sometimes without a FireWire connection. Is there any other way of doing that?
I would assume that Apple's going to enable target disk mode via USB. They've got to. It's too useful.
They've got to, but at least for the moment, and they haven't announced plans to do that, it's gone for the moment.
So for the moment, I wouldn't be able to do that until they figure out a way of doing that with USB.
That's right. Don't buy a MacBook right now.
Which means that also upgrades are off the table, because that was done through a FireWire connection as well.
I know what you're saying, Miles.
Yeah.
What we're saying is if you buy a new computer and you've got two of the computers, you want to migrate it over, you use that cable. Well, that's the thing is that's not a problem for quite a while because these new books.
Right away. You can do it with Cat 5.
Hold on, Nick's saying something. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, that, in other words, when I bought my wife the MacBook a year ago, and, you know, that's how I, you know, we just hit that button and it migrated her old system, you know, everything, not the system, but, you know, all of her applications, documents, and, you know, in 10 minutes, she was up and running on her new computer that looked just like her old computer, you know.
So, in other words, to
move from my old PowerBook to there, I won't be able to do that,
What you want to do right now, I don't have the answer directly for you, but if you do participate in our forums, we'll answer it for you this way. But what you need to do is kind of watch the Apple forum discussion and stuff to find out if target disk mode is going to be enabled for USB.
Okay.
So if that happens, then you'll be target disk mode. Yeah.
Target disk mode.
Thank you, Nick, for the call.
I have another question. Maybe you can answer just real quick.
Go ahead.
If I decided to not get this and I need a new laptop, do I have another option? I need a new Mac laptop. Is there a reasonable option?
The MacBook Pro, which I think starts above $2,000.
You can also check different online retailers that sell, like eSales and Otherworld Computing and Power Max. They will have stock left. Now's the time to get it.
Go back to the old version.
And you might be able to get a good deal on them.
Yeah.
Or the refurbished. Because
I don't know that I want to spend the money on the MacBook Pro because it's considerably more.
It's like twice as much.
Yeah, okay.
Then I think John's recommendation of getting an older new MacBook would be good.
While they're still new in the box.
Or you hope that Apple's going to solve this problem by releasing target disk mode for USB 2, and then in which case it's not going to be much of a concern.
Yeah, because I've got a PowerBook that's 5 years old, and the disk drive is broken on it, and it's like, it's not worth fixing a disk drive on a five-year-old computer.
Is it the hard drive?
No, the CD, the CD-DVD drive.
Yeah. Thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Do you guys know of any technical limitations of plugging one into another via USB, just two computers directly in? I know you don't find mail-to-mail USB cables for a good reason, because you can damage things by plugging them into each
other. Because
the
power.
That's a good question. You don't want to normally plug in the ports together, and that's probably why Apple's never made it target disk mode that way. Mm-hmm. But if you specifically set up it to be reversed like that and shut the power down to it, then you could do it. Can you follow?
Yeah.
So you'd have to make sure both computers are updated with whatever release Apple has.
It would only be the target computer that would be the problem. Yeah. I don't like it.
Neither
also, it
do
doesn't
I.
really solve the problem of upgrading right now. Yeah. So if you get a new MacBook, right, and you want to move your data from the old one to the new one, the new one might be able to target disk mode USB, but you don't want that to be the target disk mode. You want to be the old one to be target disk mode, right? So you can copy the data from it.
What about Cat 5, though?
I think you can do it in other ways,
You can't do target disk via Cat 5 right now, but I think that that's more reasonable than thinking USB, right?
No, you couldn't do target disk mode with Cat 5.
Because it has to boot up and
because
load Ethernet.
There's no standard to say I am a hard drive on Cat 5. There's iSCSI. You could have an iSCSI drive
NAS server.
I think it makes more sense to just connect the computers together and run a little app that actually allows you to transfer data.
Yeah.
Or even put sharing on. You might do it that way.
Yeah, but see, that's not migration. That's just bringing data over. Migration, the cool thing is you get everything.
It's all automatic.
I think you might be able to do migration with Cat 5. I know you can't with target disk mode, but I think you might be able to.
You know,
if they're both on.
You can take a hard drive and you can do a backup to it, and there are backups that you can restore from that are just like copying your
That's true.
As it is.
We use Carbon Copy Cloner.
So you just take your FireWire hard drive and...
All right. If you want to not talk about Macintosh computers, please give us a call right now. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free 1-800-655-5877. We will take calls about things other than Macintoshes.
Yeah, we beat that into the ground, huh?
Yeah, I'm going to look through the news real quick because I want to cover another story that I thought was kind of interesting. Go ahead. Yeah, Ben, what do you got? Banjo.
This is so cool.
It's ridiculously cool.
All right, so there's this banjo musician who had a hand tremor, and he underwent brain surgery to try to fix it.
And he's like a really
good
banjo player.
At the forefront. Yeah, exactly. To do this brain surgery, they actually had him bring his banjo in, and he was conscious while they were working on him, and they had him play banjo during the brain surgery to see when his playing deteriorated and when it got better so they could tweak it, because that was the most important thing for him that he did with his hands. So he wanted to maximize his ability to play banjo.
So what you're saying is he had brain surgery, and while he was doing brain surgery,
he was awake and playing banjo.
Well, you have to be awake during brain surgery anyway.
Well, he was playing banjo in the operating room during the brain surgery. And there's actually a video of this online. One of the surgeons taped it, and it's spectacular to watch. It's so funny.
And you haven't submitted that as a news item yet, so I can't turn it on. So please.
Yeah, I did submit it. It just needs to be assigned. All right. But yeah.
Yeah,
it's very surreal to watch.
It's
really weird. It's weird.
I'm loading it right now so we can get a quick listen to it. I think it's going to be a fantastic listen to it.
The audio is great because you hear the operating stuff
in the
background.
Yeah, there's not much to see, actually, in terms of the video. The video just is just a guy laying down with a banjo.
Yeah, definitely. But so this is the operating, and it's a picture of him being... his surgery happening, right? And he's got a banjo in his hands, and he's being operated on right now.
So picture him.
This guy's head's open right now, by the way. And he's in a sterile environment. Did that just sterilize the banjo?
They would have had a sterilized banjo.
Wow.
Yeah, that guy's pretty good.
Yeah, that's the before they start actually probing. So then then as the probes start happening, he messes up a couple times, and then he's get better. I'm hoping that it succeeded.
Yeah.
This would be a horrible
story. So they're tuning the human to play the banjo.
It's very cool. Yeah, the sterilization of the banjo. That's a really interesting story.
Doesn't it have a skin?
Yeah, it's got wood in it and stuff. Yeah. I don't know what they would have. Maybe they would have gotten a banjo that's like...
And maybe there's this curtain.
Put him in a giant bubble or something.
Well, like I noticed they have a curtain exactly, separating the two, yeah.
It could be that they did that.
Maybe it's possible.
It's cool.
Really cool.
Science. Yeah, brain surgery is just the most amazing stuff because you have to be awake so that they can make sure that they're not turning you off.
Yeah, definitely. From Santa Cruz, Mike, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey there. I just had a quick comment. You guys were just talking about moving data from one Mac to one of the new MacBooks and how it's going to be more difficult because of the lack of FireWire.
Uh-huh.
And just wanted to point out that Apple does include a utility called the Migration Assistant, mm-hmm. which will move your user profile and your applications and
right, and the, and the way you use Migration Assistant traditionally is you use target disk mode with the computer. So you turn off the old computer, you make it a FireWire drive, you connect the two computers up, you run Migrated Assistant, and the Migrated Assistant sees the other computer and transfers the data through that way.
Right, but Migration Assistant fully supports Ethernet.
Yeah, it does,
Wi-Fi.
Gigabit Ethernet.
Right,
yeah.
So even Wi-Fi?
Since the Mac Air, they enable it with Wi-Fi.
Wow, so I didn't know
what
that.
What do you have to do? You have to run Migration Assistant on both machines, right?
You have to run it on the old machine. They just put out an update yesterday that enabled the Wi-Fi.
Right.
You can also
that's why.
You can also do it to Time Machine. And
you can do Time Machine also. Yeah.
Thanks, Mike, for clarity.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's FireWire target disk mode for USB also. I think they put out a statement or something about
that. Shame.
It has to do with the bus controllers or something like
right,
that.
Right, I understand, because they're not actually managing the chip that actually runs the bus controller, so it's hard to
exactly.
actually trade for it from a host to it. Yeah.
So long, FireWire target disk mode.
It was such a good thing when it lasted.
I know, we loved you so much.
Thanks, Mike, for the call.
All right, take care, guys.
Man, it goes the way of the Apple Alt-Shift-Delete to boot from target disk.
So the
SCSI had.
So the implications of that are you had FireWire 400 at the very least, so 400 megabits per second. So now it's over either Ethernet, which is a gigabit per second, or Wi-Fi, which is a maximum of, 54?
Yeah, it would be pretty slow.
Unless
you're running out.
So, Miles, what's up with cell phones and being able to turn off their use? Can you talk about that story? It's kind of interesting.
Sorry, cell phones being able to turn off their use?
Yeah, was that Ben's?
Yeah, I had the one.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Go, Miles, go. No, it's just some software that some cell phone service providers have installed, and actually they're in talks to do more. But this software can actually hold driver cell phone calls while they appear to be traveling at car-like speeds. And of course, there's an override mode in case you're a passenger in a car or a passenger on a bus. But this is especially great for parents who want to keep their newly driving teen from driving and talking on their phone or driving and texting, because a lot of people do that. And it's not actually the hand on the cell phone that causes as many crashes as it is the distraction, especially when you first receive a call. It's either the trying to figure out who it is by, who is this? Hi, Joe.
And it's the responding to in a stress moment in the car. Like, oh, I got to answer the phone. That stress takes you away from your driving.
It's hard to ignore a ringing phone because we've been conditioned all our lives. And so either you turn off your phone or you get stressed out and feel like you want to answer it, and try not to.
This wouldn't be a phone application. This would be actually a service from the cell phone company,
right? Yeah, this is at that level.
So what would happen is as the phone goes through different cell sites, if it's going at a certain speed that's too fast, that means mm-hmm. danger speed, it would just not take incoming calls at that point.
Yeah, and actually, if you're the incoming caller and you're calling someone who appears to be driving according to the service, it'll actually give you choices. It'll say, do you want to leave a message? Do you want to leave an emergency voice? voicemail if it's really, really important, or do you want to request a call back, or you know, something like that. So they've thought of those options. And
that's
everything.
Great. I really like that idea.
Once you stop driving, you can call them back.
All right. John, next news story.
Well, we've talked about the large... We talked about Space Telescope, and we talked about the Particle Collider. There's a new satellite going up that kind of combines the two. It's called IBEX. It's going to be launched tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
IBEX stands for Interstellar Boundary Explorer. You know, they're running out of names for these things. it's going to send up two atom detectors. And what they're going to do is they're going to look at the point where the heliosphere, which is... the sun has this pressure around it that keeps a lot of bad things in space at bay, you know, cosmic rays and stuff like that. We're shielded by the heliosphere of our sun. So there's a point at which atoms collide with this heliosphere and then go around and collide with each other when they, as they hit the heliosphere.
Is that outside the space of Earth?
Way outside the space of Earth. Oh, yeah.
At the edge of the solar system.
Yeah.
Like Pioneer 10 just crossed the heliopause.
Right.
Which is,
exactly.
Okay. Sure.
So what they're going to do is they're going to have two detectors looking at these particles colliding at... you know, millions of miles per hour.
So we're going to get this probe's going to go out to the heliosphere and hang out there?
No. We're going to be using these. These are going to be in Earth orbit, and they're going to be looking using these detectors that can detect these atoms as they collide and looking for the particles that are released and things like that. So it's kind of a particle detection in space, looking at these particles that are colliding, you know, in nature. So
it's trying to
be what the LHC is doing.
Yeah. Astronomy's cool. Thank you. Joanne, welcome to GeekSpeak from Santa Cruz.
Hi, Jonna.
Oh, Jonna. So sorry.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, that's me. A couple weeks ago, you talked about buying unencrypted music from iTunes, and you didn't mention how to actually do that. I was curious about how to get MP3s from iTunes.
How do you do that, you guys? Do you know how to do that?
Do they give you MP3s? I don't think they give you actually MP3s, but they give you unencrypted music. Or
right.
They give you DRM-free music.
DRM-free? I thought they were doing MP3s. Maybe they're not.
I think we're all fuzzy on this.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Oh, okay.
But you know what? We will find out.
Great.
It's a good question. Thank you so much for the call.
Sure.
Bye-bye. DRM-free iTunes Plus. Songs without copy protection or higher quality cost $1 something blah blah a piece.
Does it say what format there?
I'm looking for that.
No.
Amazon.com sells an MP3. And Apple sells in AAC.
Right, but it's not
it's DRM-free content in AAC, not
MP3. 256 kilobits AAC, yeah. Bummer.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission, and GeekSpeak is also supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam. Miles, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
John Tracy, it's so nice to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Thanks. And Ben Jaffe. And Ben, you are taking orders for media kind of work. Is that true?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, you
I'd
can
be glad to hear from you.
You can send a note to Ben by going to geekspeak.org. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's any good, but I liked it when he worked for me. So he's quite good, actually. Coming up next, we're going to be having the Click and Clack Car Talk. And, of course, later in the day, wonderful stuff all along. And I want to thank everybody who participated last week or this whole last week to KUSP for their pledges. And if you did that, you know it feels good. So thank you so much for doing it. And if you didn't, please feel free to go up to kusp.org and pledge. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.